Take your Bibles and join me in Genesis chapter 20 as we dive back into this amazing first book of your Bible, Genesis chapter 20. Anybody who knows me knows I'm a big movie fan. I love to watch movies. But I got to tell you, Hollywood just is out of ideas, aren't they? They don't have anything new for us anymore. We've seen it all at this point. All they pump out these days, seems like, are remakes, reboots, and sequels. And let's be honest, there's some lousy sequels, aren't there? I went online the other day and I looked up worst movie sequels of all time. And there are a stunning number of lists called worst movie sequels. Now, it's interesting to see which sequels appear on all the lists. Pretty much every Police Academy movie ever made is on these lists, okay? I remember seeing Big Mama's House 2 a lot on these lists. Let's see, Son of the Mask, I think, was one of them that was on there. Stayin' Alive, that's the sequel to Saturday Night Fever. Now, I've never seen Stayin' Alive, but the director was Sylvester Stallone, so that tells you something maybe right there. But it almost is agreed upon that the worst movie sequel of all time is Jaws 4. Now, I got to tell you, my favorite movie is the original Jaws. That might surprise you. Pastor Scott's favorite movie is Jaws. Why is it Jaws? Well, I don't know what to tell you. I love Steven Spielberg movies. I think the composer John Williams is the best film composer there is. It's just got some iconic moments. There's one of the best monologues in film history. But Jaws has never had a good sequel. I mean, all the sequels are terrible. Jaws 2 was terrible. Jaws 3 was terrible. But let me tell you, both of those movies are Citizen Kane compared to Jaws 4. It's called Jaws 4, The Revenge. The tagline is, "This time, it's personal." As though this shark has a grudge against Chief Brody and his family. Now, it's just the stupidest. The special effects are awful. What makes sequels so lousy often is that there's nothing new. It's just a retread. They just take some of the ideas that made the original interesting, but you're watching it and you're going, I feel like I've seen this before, but it's somehow dumber. And in our text today, we are being treated to what at first seems kind of like a bad sequel. We feel like we've seen this before. And if I were to make a sequel and release this in the theater, this text today, we might call it, She's My Sister Too. Now, why would we call it that? Let me just take you back to Genesis chapter 12. You'll remember that God has established his covenant with Abram, and he's told him, I'm going to give you nationhood status, I'm going to give you descendants, land, blessing, all of this, but get up, leave the land where you are now, go to the land that I'm going to show you. And so there's this moment of faith where Abram packs up everything and he just heads for Canaan. And it's a great start to a faith adventure, but we don't even make it 10 verses before he does a face plant. He falls on his face. There's a total flop. Look what happens here. It says in Genesis 12, verse 10, now there was a famine in the land. There was a famine in the land. So here's Abram. He's trusting God in all the big things. God's going to give me land. He's going to give me descendants. He's going to bless me. But he's having trouble trusting God in the small things. Daily provision. It says, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And when he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance. And when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. And so there is recognized by Abram a cause and effect. If you have a beautiful wife, somebody's going to try to kill you and take her. And so he says in verse 13, say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. Okay, so from then on, we see Abram's plan backfire. We've already talked through this little text before. The Pharaoh does indeed take his wife and make her his own wife. And so now the promise of God that he would have a nation that would come from him, that person that he needs with whom to procreate and create offspring, she has been abducted and she is now part of the Pharaoh's harem. And so she's at risk. And so there's obviously going to be some frustration between these two spouses. And then it becomes a humiliating affair because the Pharaoh realizes what's going on, and this godless or rather pagan man now rebukes God's righteous chosen patriarch. And so humiliation ensues, and Abram has to leave with his tail between his legs. But through it all, he learns a valuable lesson, and he renews his commitment to God, and he recommits his life to the Lord. And so this is kind of the character arc of that story. The chosen one falls on his face and then learns a valuable lesson and rises to the occasion. And that is the arc, and that is the plot of She's My Sister 1. Now, it's 25 years later. How many of you guys out here, you've been married for at least 20 years? How many of you, when you first got married, you did some dumb stuff, but it's 20 years later and you have never done any dumb stuff ever again? Anybody? Oh, one down here. Okay. All right. You know what happens to liars, right? Anyway, let's see how it goes with Abraham is his name now. Let's look at this. Genesis chapter 20, verse 1. From there, Abraham journeyed toward the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur, and he sojourned in Gerar. All right, so here's the context of what's going on by chapter 20. Two chapters ago, chapter 18, the Lord shows up at Abraham and Sarah's place, and he says, 1 year from now, you're going to have a son. Sarah is going to give birth. 1 year from now. Okay, that's chapter 18. Chapter 19. The Lord now levels Sodom and Gomorrah, just destroys it for wickedness. But he spares the life of Abraham's nephew, Lot, and most of his family. That's chapter 19. So we're in the aftermath of that. And so Abraham has decided to move because property value around the Sodom region is no longer what it once was. And so he says, I don't want to look at this smoldering aftermath. And so I'm going to go as far as I can. And he does. He gets as far away from Sodom as he possibly can. He goes all the way across Canaan. It's like he lived in Nag's Head and he's moving to Pigeon Forge. He is going a fur piece, okay? And he gets to this place called Gerar. Now, Gerar is Philistine country. It's very close to Egypt. Why he'd want to go back to Egypt, I don't know, considering what happened there last time. But they've got sort of a city-state there and a regional ruler who goes by the name Abimelech. Now, Abimelech is probably a title of sorts. We're going to meet another guy named Abimelech in a few chapters, years later. So I think that this is sort of an office that is held there. And it says in verse 2, as Abraham comes into this political scene, very similar to what he encountered long ago in Egypt, it says in verse 2, and Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. Uh-oh. He's done it again. How can this be? Come on, Abraham. You already sang this song. What are we doing going back to the second verse here? I mean, you learn your lesson. A righteous person would never repeat the same sin twice, would they? Let me just tell you something. In the Grimm line, there is what you'd call a hothead gene. Okay? Well, it's not really fair to call it a gene because that would imply that I'm sort of hardwired genetically to bust out this persona, which I call Dark Scott. All right? Dark Scott has made a few appearances more than a few appearances over the years. 1998, I'm on campus, Liberty University. I'm in the dorms there. I live in the senior dorms, what was then called the senior dorms. There is on each floor what's called, there are four things called a quad. There are four quads. It's divided into four sections. In each quad, there are five rooms, five dorm rooms. There are two guys to a room. There is a living area, and then there are two community bathrooms. And I lived in a quad with the members of this music group that I traveled with. And we had these bathrooms, and they were community bathrooms. There were two showers, there were two sinks, and there was one toilet in each community bathroom. And we had just gotten in, I recall, on a Friday night. We'd been out touring, traveling, did a concert, got in really late, and we all crashed. The next morning was Saturday morning, and I wake up, and shall we say, nature is calling. And so at this time, I remember one of the bathrooms, the toilet did not work. So literally, there's one working toilet for 10 guys. And so I go down the hall, and I grab the handle of the door, and the bathroom door is locked. and I can hear the shower running, and I know what's happened. We had a quirky guitarist who had this annoying habit of whenever he'd get up early, and he got up early every morning, and he took a long shower, and he'd lock the door of the community bathroom. And so I was agitated by this, and I'm banging on the door because I know who it is. I go, dude, come on. And I hear him from the shower, I'll be out in a minute. And so I wait and I wait, and it's getting uncomfortable. And I'm steamed. And Dark Scott appears. And so I go down to the kitchen and I get a butter knife. And I jimmy that door open and I go in there and I am ticked off because we've already had this conversation. You can't do this, dude. And I see his clothes. And I see his keys. And I take his clothes and his keys, and I go and I put his clothes in his room and I lock his room up. I mean, I'm ticked. And I put his keys in my room. And then I go back to the kitchen and I fill up a pitcher of ice water. Okay, I'm not looking for affirmation about this. Okay, I'm very embarrassed I did this. I think you know what I did. I'm so mad, I forgot to pee, all right? And so I just unleash on this guy. I let him have it verbally. And I mean, it's not pretty. It's just not pretty. And finally, later I come to my senses and I go back to him. I go, all right, dude, listen, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm really sorry. Please forgive me. I got in the flesh. I was upset and all this stuff. And he said, well, forgive me. I won't do it again, blah, blah, blah. We kind of had a little come to Jesus. Everything was fine, okay? Dark Scott, gone. Okay? 2012, I'm coming back from Israel, of all places, my wife and I, and we are flying in, all right? We had this mountaintop experience in the Holy Land. I've fallen in love with my Bible again, and we're coming back. It's an incredible trip, and we fly into Philadelphia to connect to a different flight and go on to our home state of California, and we get there, and the flight is delayed 1 hour, and then it's delayed another hour. And then another hour, and I'm starting to get worried that it's going to be canceled and we're going to have to be stuck in Philadelphia. And that's a problem because my car keys, we're going to fly into San Fran and drive back to Modesto. My car keys are in my checked bag. And so I need to know what's going on so I get my bag off of this plane. And I go to the lady and they're not telling us anything. And I'm getting irritated and I'm tired and I'm cranky. And I don't remember what I said, but I do recall she said to me, sir, step back. Unless you want to be removed from this flight. And I go, all right, fine. And I go and I'm red-faced and I sit down next to my wife and she doesn't know what happened in that conversation, but she can see my emotional state. She says, did you just get us kicked off this flight? I go, woman? I didn't say that. No, I'm not an idiot, okay? And sure enough, they cancel the flight. And I'm like, well, I got to get my keys out of my bag. So I go down to baggage claim and they say, I'm sorry, the plane's been put away for the night. You're going to have to stay the night at the gate. We've got cots up there. So please just go up, get a cot, and the flight will resume in the morning. So we go up and I'm fuming. And then we find out it's so late, they've closed the gates. And we spent the night in baggage claim. And Dark Scott is there, man. I mean, he's present. And so I've made, you know, life even worse for my poor wife, okay? And so I made a little repeat visit. 2021. Apparently, nature calling and not being able to respond summons Dark Scott. Also, being very, very tired summons Dark Scott. As well, hunger has the same effect. A day came where I had not eaten all day. I had a series of meetings. I was very busy. I come home. I say, what are you thinking for dinner? My wife says, how about we order Five Guys? I'm like, amen and hallelujah. So she calls up Five Guys Burgers, places an order. She says, all right, I've paid for it. Can you go down and just pick it up? It's all ready. I go, great. She goes, yeah, just show them the code on your phone. I go, okay. So I go down there. I get out of the car. I realize I forgot my phone. It's at home. I'm thinking, this won't be a problem. I'll just go in. I'll explain the situation. I go in. I say, hey, so my wife called in an order. I forgot my phone. The name is Scott, and she just called, talked to a guy about 20 minutes ago. And the guy goes, don't have any orders by that name. I said, well, she just called. It's paid for. And he goes, sorry. And I'm thinking, did my wife call a different Five Guys? What's going on? And so I drive all the way home and I go, what's happened? She goes, yeah, I know. I took care of it. It's paid for. That's the one. You were at the right one. And I go, what's going on? So I get my phone, I go back to the place, I come in, I go, all right, here's my code. And he goes, and I had seen this bag sitting on the shelf when I was there the first time. And he goes, oh yeah. And he reaches over, grabs a bag, and hands it to me. I'm like, that's the bag that was there before. And I just unleash on this guy. And then he starts to cry. And I'm like, oh, shh. No, it's okay, it's okay. He's like, this is the worst first week on a job ever. And so I apologize and all this stuff. So here's my point after that lengthy, humiliating testimony of my own weakness. I can identify with Abraham, and I bet you can too. This is a text that is applicable for any believer, because when you see a heavy hitter like Abraham blunder and then blunder again, there's a lot of passages, or pastors rather, that come to this passage and they go, I already taught this story. We already heard this story. What's the point of this? We don't need to rehash this. This is here for a reason. It's to show us that righteous people can sin repeatedly. We can commit the same faux pas and errors. The question is not, do people of faith blow it repeatedly? The question is, what does God think about that? How does God respond to us when we do that? So let's look at this very applicable text here. It says, and Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah, because of course she did, because he doesn't have any qualms. She's Abraham's sister, and he finds her beautiful. Now that may confuse you. Some of you, if you've been following along, you're like, well, isn't Sarah like 90? Isn't she like 90? Why? What does this guy's harem look like? The Golden Girls? What is this? Well, you know, we've talked about this. It's one of a few things. Could be that in Genesis, people just aged at a different rate. I mean, we know that they lived much older, much longer. So she wouldn't necessarily look like someone today in that same phase of life. That's one possibility. Another is that Abimelech, someone like that, would not necessarily marry just for romantic reasons. This could be a very political thing. Here's this very wealthy, very influential guy from Canaan. This is his sister. It could be a very politically savvy move for an Abimelech to marry into that family. But I kind of gravitate toward this other explanation, which is that the Lord told Sarah, 1 year from this point, you're going to give birth. Now she's 90, which means God is going to do a miracle in this woman. He is doing a work in her body at this phase of life. Her biology is going to run in reverse so as to allow her to have a baby. And I believe that there is a renewed beauty in Sarah. I think that she's going to have to take care of a baby, nurse a baby, all of these things. I think that there is a beauty that is restored to her at this point. But in any case, Abimelech says, let's get hitched. And so he takes her as his wife. But look at verse 3. It says, but God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, behold, you are a dead man. You're a dead man because of the woman you've taken, for she's a man's wife. Now, Abimelech had not approached her. That means he'd not consummated anything, thank the Lord. And so he said, Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he himself not say to me, she is my sister, and she herself said, he is my brother? In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this. And then God said to him, in the dream, yes, I know you have done this in the integrity of your heart. And it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. And so this shows us something. Note what God says. He said, I kept you from sinning against who? Abraham? Sarah? No. He said, I kept you from sinning against me. What does that tell you? That tells you marriage is God's institution. When adultery is committed, that is not merely a sin against the spouse of the person that you are committing adultery with. It's a sin against a holy God whose idea it was that marriage exists. It's his institution. It's sacred. Now, look at verse 7. He says, but now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. So Abimelech rose early in the morning. I bet he did. I bet he didn't sleep a wink. And he called his servants and told them all these things, and the men were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You've done to me things that ought not be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing?" Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides," he says, I love this, "she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife." So Abraham's trying to get off on a technicality here. Now, some of you saw his explanation and you just thought to yourself, ew, they're half siblings and they're married. Not uncommon in this culture, really not for a married couple to share one parent. So this is apparently very common. They did share a father, not a mother. And so, they shared a mother, not a father. Or no, it's the other way around. I'm a pastor, you know. But let's get one thing right. Abraham knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. He's not getting off on a technicality. He said, "She's my sister," meaning she's not my wife. He's trying to imply that they're not married. Okay, we know what he's doing. So what can we learn from this serial deception? What do believers reap from this? Well, this act of Abraham is an act of cowardice. Is he looking out for his wife? No, he's looking out for his own skin. It's also an act of dishonor. Dishonor. God calls him a prophet. We just saw that. And yet he's putting God to open shame to the point that this polytheistic Philistine is going to get in his face and say, "What have you done?" How embarrassing. That's happened before with the Pharaoh. It was an act of recklessness. Here God's made him this promise. You're going to have a mighty nation come from you. And now he's put himself in a situation where the person that he is to procreate with is now the wife of another man. What would happen if she were to sleep with Abimelech and then have a baby? What would be the whisperings about Isaac, that baby? What would people say? What would people think about Abraham? Ah, I see the problem now. Sarah just needed a real man. And that would cast aspersions on what God was doing for Abraham. And then it's an act of repetition. We've seen this before. And so we come back to this question. Why do the righteous repeatedly commit the same sins? Here's Abraham's excuse, verse 13. It says, he said, "And when God caused me to wander from my father's house," how long ago was that? That's 25 years back. "I said to her, 'This is the kindness you must do to me. Every place to which we come, say of me, he is my brother.'" All right? Abraham's problem started 25 years in the past, and he has brought a bit of theological baggage from his old life into his new life as a believer. He told Sarah when they first got into the land of promise, "Here's what we do. Whenever we encounter pagan peoples, you just tell everybody that you're my sister, and then they'll spare my life." Why did he do that? Because that is the kind of mindset that he had as an unbeliever. Back in Haran, he was not born a righteous patriarch. He grew up and he became a successful businessman. He did whatever it took. He was an entrepreneur. He understands the cutthroat business of competition and how you got to do what you got to do to survive and get ahead. You'll do whatever it takes. And he has brought that mentality into his life of faith. How many of us, when we get saved, we bring in old thinking? Because here's what you need to learn from Abraham's example in your notes. You sin when you bring old thinking into your new life. People who get saved, but they don't understand, they don't change their view on relationships, they're still destined to struggle with that, even though they're born again. And a lot of born again Christians have brought into their relationship as believers mentalities and assumptions that they had when they were an unbeliever. And it's problematic. There are views on sexuality that people will bring into their faith life. They've just never changed some of their old thinking. And so we have trained ourselves as unbelievers to adopt a certain mindset. And then when we come to faith, we know the right things to believe in and to trust in for our eternity, but we're still adopting the ways of the world. And this is an old habit and an old erroneous mindset, some old baggage that Abraham has brought from Haran. And we got to guard against that. Because Paul writes in Romans 12, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God. He doesn't want you to operate according to your old thinking, believer. He wants you to constantly be renewed according to the mind of God. And so what God does with Abraham's failure here is he's not going to let him get away with it. He's not going to let him slide. He doesn't shrug his heavenly shoulders and say, ah, well, you know, boys will be boys. Patriarchs will be patriarchs. Oh, that Abram. No, he busts him. Why does he do that? Because he's God's man. In your notes, here's what we learn. Your maturity matters more to God than your happiness or even your safety. See, God refuses to bless our compromises. He's not going to just sign off on what we do. He would rather you be unhappy. He would rather you cry and later be holy than for you to be happy and you end up insignificant for his cause. He's got a plan for Abraham, and so he's not going to let Abraham get away with his disobedience. I have never seen a Christian be significant for God who had a very low view of sin. A very low view of holiness. Sin matters to God. We look at some of the writings of the heavy hitters of the Bible. What did David say in Psalm 139? He said, search me, O God. Know my heart. Try me. Know my thoughts. He wants God to examine him. Paul wrote to Timothy, 2 Timothy 2, flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness. Peter writes in 1 Peter 2, beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. It's serious. James, in James 4, he says, you adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Sin is very serious to God. Just because you're born again, just because your eternity is secure, you're going to go to heaven when you die. It's not that God doesn't care about sin in your life, in obedience. He cares. He knows that you're still susceptible to it. You still have this old nature. And so he doesn't intend for you to fall prey to old thinking and to sinful lifestyles. And that is the same reason for which God stops Abraham in his tracks and he busts him in his sin. He says, we've got to deal with this right now. It is the mercy of God to bust us in our sin. You read in Romans 1, it says that he gave them over to shameful lusts. Okay, that's the wrath of God. When God gives somebody over, if an unbeliever has rejected, and they've sought the world, and they've been presented with the truth and repeatedly they reject it, there's a point where God gives them over. Which means that when he doesn't let us get away with our pursuit of sinfulness, that is an act of mercy. That's an act of mercy. Years ago, I knew a guy in ministry. He was a youth pastor, and he served at a megachurch that I was once on staff at. My sister was serving. She was much younger then. She was serving under him in his ministry, in the youth ministry there. And she called me one day, and she was in tears because the news had broken that this youth pastor had solicited a prostitute online. And he'd arranged to go and meet this prostitute at a motel. And when he got there, he walked right into a police sting. He was busted and they arrested him, and his ministry at this church was done, and his marriage was now going to go through the ringer. And my sister was distraught over this because she and her friends all really respected this guy. And I said, listen, I know you're hurting. I said, but I want you to know something else. This is a good thing. And she said, how could this be a good thing? I said, it's a good thing that God hasn't let him get away with it. It's an act of mercy. To bring something like this into the light puts you in a position where you can have healing, where you can have restoration. If he was allowed to remain in the dark, he would have continued to descend further. It's an act of mercy. God is going to bring Abraham into a place of healing. And he will do the same for you, believer. In your notes, you need to learn this. God will not let you suffer beyond his commitment to you. Now, your relationship with God is different from a covenantal standpoint than Abraham's, okay? Your covenant with God is different from the one that God had with Abraham. You're not Abraham. I'm not Abraham. The church is not Israel, okay? But his commitment level to you is no different. He is utterly committed to you. He would not compromise his promise to Abraham. He will not compromise his promise to you. He will bend you, but he will never break you irreparably. He will chasten you, but he will never destroy you. And here's the amazing thing that we see, that God continues to use Abraham. He does. You remember what I read in verse 7? I wonder if this caught your attention here. Verse 7, God tells Abimelech, "Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you, and you shall live." What? Abraham's the reason Abimelech is in this fix. What was Abimelech thinking? He's a prophet. The liar? This guy's going to pray for me. The guy who lied and said his wife is his sister. What does this tell us? It tells us that no matter how we screw up, God can still use you. He hasn't given up on you. In your notes, despite your failure, God still has a purpose for you. Are you glad about that? I'm glad about that. I'm glad God hasn't written me off after all my dark Scott moments, you know? I know the latest trend is to cancel people when they fail. You know, we all get fed up. We hear about cancel culture. Let me tell you something. We invented cancel culture. The church invented cancel culture. When a Christian with a public platform falls on his face, there is nobody more prepared to come and to pronounce that person's influence dead and to cremate the remains and scatter the ashes. Nobody does that quicker than other Christians. We are guilty of that. It is an odd thing. Of all people, you would think that Christians would be on board with the idea of second chances, and yet we don't. Our default is, nope, you're done. You're anathema. Now, are there disqualifying things for the likes of pastors? I believe that there are. This is a biblical office. Pastors and elders, they have to be held to a certain standard. When they fall from those standards, if I committed adultery on my wife, I believe that I should step down. Now, does that mean that God is done with me? No, it does not. It just means there's a specific office and role that I no longer qualify for. Okay, if there are very specific things, you can read 1 Timothy, Titus, you gotta meet these requirements. But if I am disqualified from that kind of a role, does that mean that God can never use me in a different role? No, it just means God will now change the way that I am to be effective for him. And God will never give up 100% on his righteous no matter what they do. And we've all got baggage, okay? The human problem is we're all human. If I knew everything about your past in my humanness, I might be a little nervous about you sitting in here today. I've already shared to you about some of my past. Some of you are like, we hired this guy? What in the world? Okay, but God uses all sinners. Are you glad? Amen. So let's shift over to the New Testament because there's a great example of this there. Christ told the disciples in the upper room, he said, all you guys are going to turn from me. You're all going to turn away from me. And who is it that got up and made this big display? It was Peter. Peter said, Lord, I will never turn from you. I can't speak for these other schmoes, but God, listen. I mean, come on. This is the rock you're talking about. Okay, Dwayne Johnson got nothing on the rock. Peter, I'm your man. I will never turn away from you. What was he really saying? He's saying, I love you more than these guys love you. That's what he was saying. And Jesus said, Peter, before the rooster crows, you're going to deny me three times. I'm going to give you a reminder every morning of your life when that first century alarm clock goes off. You hear that rooster crowing. You're going to be reminded that I use you in spite of you, not because of you. I'm sure Peter sniffed at that. He probably thought, oh, I'll show him. I'll show all these guys. And later that night in the Garden of Gethsemane, when those soldiers came to take Christ, Peter was quick to whip out his sword. He got huffy. He turned into Dark Peter, you know? And he takes his sword out. But he's so discombobulated that he doesn't even go after the right guy. You got a battalion of armed guards. He goes after an unarmed servant. And he doesn't even do it right. He means to take off the guy's head, and all he does is slice off his ear. And to make matters more embarrassing, Jesus says, Peter, get out of the way. And he goes over and he heals the guy. What a rebuke. How humiliating for Peter. I can see him, sweaty, red-faced, huffy. And when Jesus is led away, Peter, still filled with pride, trying to prove himself, he follows at a distance. They take Jesus. They're berating him. They're interrogating him. Peter's pacing outside by the fire. Somebody recognizes him. They say, hey, you're one of his followers. And in his frustration and angst, he just blurts out. He doesn't even think about it. He blurts out. He goes, no, I'm not. And then he runs and he goes to hide in the crowd. But he can't hide in the crowd because somebody in the crowd says, you're one of them. You're one of the followers of the Nazarene. And he says, no, I don't know the man. And then a little girl, a little servant girl comes up and says, ah, yes, you are. I recognize your Galilean accent. You're one of his followers. He goes, I'm telling you, I don't know the man. Can you imagine the cold sweat? His heart just stops when he hears the crowing of that sound. And one of the Gospels tells us he turns and he looks right into the face of Jesus. And he runs off crying like a baby. And he's overcome with shame. You don't even see Peter at the crucifixion. Can't even bring himself to show up. Can't show his face. Shame is a deadly thing. My brother and I used to love this movie called The Edge. Anthony Hopkins. Back in the 90s, they never made a sequel, thank God. He's a billionaire, and he takes his entourage on a trip up to Alaska, and they have a mishap in the plane over the bay there. They strike birds in the air, and the plane goes down, and they swim to shore, and it's a survival movie. They're trying to survive in the wilderness, and they fight off grizzly bears and all this stuff. But he has this monologue where he says, you know, I read an interesting book one time that said most people lost in the wilds, they die of shame. They die of shame. What did I do wrong? How could I have gotten myself into this? And they sit there and they die because they didn't do the one thing that would have saved their life. What is that? Thinking. And many of us, we commit an error like Abraham did and like Peter did, and we get consumed with shame. And we don't do the thing that is important. And it's thinking, not thinking about how to get ourselves out of this fix. It's thinking of ourselves as God thinks of us. It's seeing ourselves the way God sees us. That's what he wants. That's what Peter could not do. And we know that because even after Peter and John discover the empty tomb, even after Christ appears in the flesh, to all the disciples, Peter still can't bring himself to face him. And he runs off and he goes back to what he knows. He goes back and he goes fishing. He goes fishing, not for leisure, not because he's hungry. Fishing is his old life. He's making a statement, God's done with me. I denied him 3 times. He couldn't possibly have a purpose for me. I'm going to go back to doing what I used to do because that's all that I am. But Jesus comes and he finds him. And Peter and the other boys are in the boat and Jesus is on the shore and he calls to him. And John says, it's the Lord. Peter looks up. And the Gospels tell us that Peter then puts on his outer cloak, which means you would strip down to go fishing. That was the custom. So he puts on his clothing and then he jumps in the water. Seems a little backwards, doesn't it? That you'd clothe up and then jump in the water? Why'd he do that? He's still ashamed. He doesn't want to appear uncovered before the Lord. He's kind of like Adam and Eve in the garden with their pathetic little fig leaves. And he's there with Christ and they're having breakfast by the sea. And we read in John 21, verse 15, when they'd finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? More than these what? What did he mean by that? You remember what Peter was saying in the upper room? Essentially, he was saying, Lord, I love you more than these guys love you. And Jesus saying, you still feel that way? Do you love me more than these others? And the word that he uses for love is a very specific word. It's the Greek word agapeo. It comes from agape, which is a divine love, a sacrificial love, a giving love. It's the same love Christ demonstrated while on the cross. And Peter responds to him. He says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. But Peter doesn't use agapeo. He uses another word for love, the word phileo. It's a brotherly love. We get Philadelphia from that. It's a human, just a relational, it's a lesser love. Verse 16, he said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Agape. He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. He said to him, tend my sheep. Both times he told him, feed my sheep. Tend my sheep. And Peter continues to use a diminished word because he's trying to describe his humbled state. He's telegraphing his shame to Christ. In verse 17, he said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And it says Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know I love you. Why is he grieved? Because he said it to him three times. How many times did Peter deny Christ? Three. And so Jesus is posing the same question three times, not to elicit some form of contrition. He knows that Peter's sorry. He's not trying to punish Peter. He's not trying to get him to say he'll never do it again. He knows that we're going to repeat our sins, any one of us. It's to bring him to an understanding, because this time, when he asked that question, Jesus doesn't use some form of agape, the divine love. He uses Peter's word. He says, do you phileo me? As if to say, do you even understand what that word means? I know you're trying to telegraph how humble you are, how contrite you are, but do you even understand what that word means? And then he says to him, feed my sheep. It wasn't just that he's asking him three times, do you love me? Don't miss that he's also saying to him three times, feed my sheep. What does that tell you? That tells you Jesus still has a purpose for Peter. Peter's done a face plant, big time, but Christ loves him and still wants to use him. He's in the business of using fallen things. Now we circle back to Abraham. It's abundantly clear, even to the likes of Abimelech, that Abraham is still God's man. Verse 14, then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, behold, my land is before you. Dwell wherever it pleases you. To Sarah, he said, behold, I've given your brother. Calls him her brother. Ha! He's just trying to be nice. He's not trying to offend. I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It's a sign of your innocence. Your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you. He's protecting her testimony and her dignity. And before everyone, you are vindicated. Okay? And so this pagan, no matter what has happened, he has this understanding that God will not give up on his elect. And it says in verse 17 that Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech. And also healed his wife and female slaves so that they also bore children. For the Lord had closed the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. And what we learn in your notes is that ultimately, as we see Abraham, though he has failed, God is using him. In your notes, ultimately, our righteousness is all God remembers. When you think of Abraham, do you think of this? Do you think of his failure? If you ask any Jew in the world who all revere Abraham, tell me what you think of when you think of Abraham. They say faithfulness. It is his faithfulness. He is our father Abraham. He's mentioned in the New Testament, and the four things that he is noted for in the New Testament is that he left the land where he grew up when God told him to go. He left in faith. Hebrews 11:8, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place that he was to receive as an inheritance, but he didn't know where he was going. He left. Secondly, we see that he lived in that land. Hebrews 11:9, by faith he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. He was a sojourner in that land. He left the old land. He went to the new land. He lived in that land. And then third, Paul says in Romans 4, what does the scripture say? It says Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. He believed. He left his old life. He lived in the land of promise, and he believed, and it was counted to him for righteousness. And then fourth, Hebrews 11:17, it says, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. We're gonna read about this soon. And he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son. He sacrificed to the Lord. He surrendered what God had given him. The only thing he had, he gave to God. He left, he lived, he believed, he offered. Folks, that is what God calls us to do. Every sequel that is any good is good because there's a character arc. There is development in the main character. By the end of a franchise, if it's a good one, the main character is not exactly the same as he was when he started. There's growth that happens along the way. Folks, here's God's character arc for the believer. Leave, live, believe, surrender. We leave our old life of sin behind. We live by faith in the promise of God. We believe in the power of salvation through God and Christ who justifies us. And we surrender whatever we have to the Lord, whatever he asks of us. That's what we're called to do. We're not perfect. So get that out of your head. But God can use imperfect things. It's not anything about you that makes you a worthy servant. It's by faith, though you are fallen, that you follow, you leave, you live, you believe, you surrender, and God will use you. Bow with me.